I want to talk about the subject of God's people as strangers and pilgrims. The word pilgrim itself has acquired some connotations that cause us to miss entirely the point of the Bible when the Bible talks about us being strangers and pilgrims here on this earth. I suppose the image that comes to most of our minds when we say the word pilgrim is people that dress in funny black suits and eat turkey, something of that nature. But the word pilgrim really means somebody that is living in a country that's not really his own country. He's from somewhere else. He is a foreigner. He is an alien living in a foreign country. And that's really the way the Bible describes our situation here in this present life. We are addressed. We are addressed, those of us right here, time and again by the Bible, as pilgrims in this world. In fact, if you look in your New Testaments at 1 Peter, the 2nd chapter, and the 11th verse, 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 11, Peter says, "Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers," or as some translations say, as pilgrims and strangers, "to abstain from fleshly lust which war against the soul." So the inspired writer, in this case the Apostle Peter, speaking to us as Christians, says, now I want to talk to you as pilgrims. I want to talk to you as strangers or as aliens, as people whose citizenship is really somewhere else, but you're having to live here in this world for the time being. Now, it is not just us in the New Testament. The fact is, as you go by and look through the Bible, God's people have always been addressed as, been talked to as, been reckoned as, and even have understood themselves to be just strangers. That is, just people who were what we might today talk about sort of a resident alien. Somebody that was living in the country here, but his heart and his possessions and his real citizenship was in another place, in another country. I invite you to turn back and look at a few characters from the Old Testament. Look at Abraham. Turn back to Genesis, the 23rd chapter. This is a passage, Genesis chapter 23, that recounts what happened when Abraham's wife, Sarah, finally died. In Genesis chapter 23, Sarah's died, and Abraham needs to get a place to bury her. And ordinarily this would be no problem. But the fact is, Abraham, though he had been promised the land of Canaan, he'd even left his homeland and his family behind and moved to the land of Canaan, didn't actually own any of that so-called promised land. And so he had to negotiate with one of the locals, a fellow by the name of Ephron the Hittite, to buy a cave in order to be able to bury his wife Sarah when she died. And so in Genesis chapter 23, if you look down in verse 3, it says, "Then Abraham rose from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth," the local inhabitants there, "saying, I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me a burial site among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight." This seems to me an especially poignant moment in the life of Abraham. I mean, there are many times throughout the book of Genesis that we're told that Abraham sojourned here, he was a stranger in such and such an area, an alien. But here, I mean, he's reached the point where he's looking down towards the end of his life and his wife has just died herself. And he has to realize that he doesn't own a place to put his foot. Everywhere he walks is something that really doesn't belong to him, because God has not yet given him this promised land. And so comes time to bury his wife, and he has to go very humbly to these people and say, look, he says, I'm just a stranger. I'm just a pilgrim, a foreigner, a sojourner among you. And he says, I want to buy a place to bury my wife. But it's, of course, not just Abraham. Jacob, likewise. We've been studying in the latter chapters of the book of Genesis just recently. And Abraham is described as a pilgrim or sojourner. Isaac is. Jacob describes himself that way. Look over to Genesis chapter 47. Just turn a few passages further on over in the book of Genesis here. Genesis chapter 47 and verse 9. Jacob, at the age of 137, which it seems to have been about the same age that Abraham was when Sarah died. He was about 10 years her senior. And she died at the age of 127, so he would have been about 137 when he said to the sons of Heth, I'm a stranger and a pilgrim. Well, here, his grandson, Jacob now, at about the same age, also is appearing before some of the local people, in this case, none other than Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And in verse 9, it says, so Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my sojourning are 130. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning. And once again, we keep encountering this word. They see, I'm just a sojourner. That is the word, again, that's a synonym of pilgrim or a resident alien. I don't really belong here. And the fact is, he couldn't point back to a single time in his life. I mean, he's describing the whole of his life. He doesn't just say, I'm kind of temporarily displaced. He looking back over the whole span of his 137 years, and even looking back beyond that to his father and his grandfather before him, he says, all of our lives we've just been sojourners. We don't really belong here. We've never really had a settled possession, a proper place that we could look at and say, that's home. We can see that attitude on the part of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But by way of contrast, we see some people in that same family who found a home there in the land of Canaan. Esau, the brother of Jacob, had found himself a home. We're told that he had married some of the local women there, and they had become a grief to his mother and father. We're told that he was essentially a profane fellow. The book of Hebrews, Hebrews chapter 11, describes Esau as being a profane man. That doesn't mean he used profanity. That's what we'd mean if we heard somebody described as a profane fellow today. When it says he was a profane man, it means he was an earthly man. He was attached to the things of this world. And we saw how when he thought he was about to die for hunger, he was ready to sell his birthright, a birthright that included a promise of spiritual things. He was very much at home in this world. He felt, I think, very much attached to the land, so to speak. And he didn't feel a need to marry within the family of the promised people there. He was an earthly fellow. Another character, in a similar way, found himself very much at home. And I think probably ceased to call himself just a sojourner. Lot, Abraham's nephew. You remember God had blessed Abraham and Lot together. And the time came when they parted ways because they had so many flocks and herds that there was fear of controversy between their herdsmen. And so Abraham said to Lot, you know, pick out where you want to go. And you go one way and whatever way you want to go and I'll go the other. You can read about this back in Genesis chapter 13. We're told that Lot looked down toward the cities of the plain, saw that they were well watered, and he moved down there. And before long, he'd moved into those cities. And he'd moved specifically into the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Cities that were known for their wickedness, but cities where apparently Lot came to feel quite at home. And it's interesting, the contrast. You know, we're never told that Abraham moved into a city and settled down there. I mean, he was always kind of out on the fringes, out on the edges, always in his tents out there. Because he was just a pilgrim, just a sojourner in that land. But Lot seems to have found himself a home and settled down and felt very much at home there in the land as it was inhabited by that wicked generation of the people of the Canaanites and the Amorites and so on. Another character that we see, if we come past the period of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, look at David. And this is especially interesting. Over in the book of Psalms, the 39th Psalm, one of David's hymns and prayers to the Lord there. In Psalm 39, and especially verse 12, David in the midst of his prayer calls out and he says, hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears, for I am a stranger with thee and a sojourner like all my fathers. And he would say the same thing over in 1 Chronicles. Let's turn over there. He expands on it a bit there. In 1 Chronicles chapter 29, back a few pages, in the 29th chapter of 1 Chronicles, And reading here, starting about verse 14, David says, again, in the context of a prayer to the Lord, he says, "But who am I and who are my people that we should be able to offer as generously as this? For all things come from thee, and from thy hand we have given thee. For we are sojourners before thee, and tenants, as all our fathers were. Our days on earth are like a shadow, and there is no hope. O Lord our God, all this abundance that we have provided to build thee a house for thy holy name is from thy hand, and all is thine." As you can see from the wording here, the context is David, though he didn't build the temple, had made up a large collection of material that they were donating to be used in the construction of the temple in the days of his son Solomon, who would follow. And this is a prayer. They're dedicating all this stuff to the service of the Lord, to be used in building the temple of the Lord. And he says, "Lord," he says, "the truth of the matter is, we're just giving you back what is already yours." He says, "The fact of the matter is, everything is yours. We don't really own anything." Because, he says, we are, after all, just sojourners here. We're just tenants. In other words, we're just living on borrowed time, so to speak, and in a borrowed place. And he says, not only us, but all of our fathers were like this too. Now, to me, the case of David is especially interesting and instructive because, you see, when we look back there to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, they calling themselves sojourners. We say, well, yeah, of course, because they hadn't got the promised land yet. But they were going to go down to Egypt, and after that, they were going to come back up, and then God was going to give them the promised land. And you say, once they got the promised land, they wouldn't be strangers anymore. I mean, then they would actually own and possess the land. And you'd think that would be the case. But you see, when we come to David, they've been there in the promised land. They've been the legal owners of that land. They've been the possessors of that promised land for hundreds of years by the time David becomes king. And yet David stands up and he says, no. He says, we're still just sojourners. We still don't really belong here. We still just living here kind of on borrowed time, borrowed land, just like all of our fathers were. And how is it that he says that? We say, no, wait a minute, David. You're in the promised land. You ought to settle down. You ought not be calling yourself a stranger and a pilgrim anymore. But I think David teaches us that there's not anywhere in this world that is really our promised land. Not anywhere. I think David really had come to understand exactly what the book of Hebrews tells us that Abraham understood. All that time that he was a stranger and a pilgrim living in tents. Look to the book of Hebrews, the 11th chapter. In Hebrews chapter 11, in verse 8, we start to read about Abraham. It says, "By faith Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance." And in verse 9 it says, "By faith he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land." Even emphasizes dwelling in tents. I think there's actually kind of a point to that. I mean, you know, if it's not really your land, why build a house? You have to move on at any time. So he says, dwelling in tents. With Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. But then it says, not that he was looking to the day when they could get in there and grab that land and take it. Says, but rather, for he was looking for a city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And it goes on a bit further and talks about the faith of Sarah and the faith of others. And in verse 11, it says, or verse 13, it says, all these died in faith without receiving the promises. But having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles. And again, it doesn't say strangers and exiles from the land of promise. It says strangers and exiles on the earth. Apparently, Abraham understood that even if he or his descendants actually got in and were able to settle down and own, in the earthly legal sense of the term, own that promised land, it still didn't really belong to them. And it still wasn't really where God was taking them. That they were looking for something that was beyond that even. In fact, in verse 14, he says, for those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. But not an earthly country, he explains. If just an earthly country, they'd have had lots of opportunity. They could have gone back to the land of Haran, for that matter, or the land of Ur. He says, and indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. If they were just looking for a place to settle down in this world, they'd have had lots of opportunities. In fact, if that's all they needed, Abraham had that to start with. He had a place there at Ur of the Chaldees. You know, he had a home. He left an earthly home to go looking for a place that God was preparing for him. And so in verse 16, but as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, it says, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. I believe that David understood that same point that the writer of Hebrews tells us about Abraham here. That no matter how much of the turf of this soil you own, none of that really belongs to us. And if we're looking for a place to call home, we're just not going to find it here. In fact, it seems to me interesting that when in the Old Testament, God had somebody he wanted to prepare for a really tough job. One of the things he typically did was he took them away from their home, made them live as a foreigner somewhere. I think about Moses. You know, Moses spent all those years growing up there in Egypt. But when God got ready to prepare him to lead the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, what did he do with him? Sent him to live for 40 years as a foreigner in the land of Midian. And so he lived there as a sojourner, as an alien. And I think probably came to understand what it means to say we are really altogether foreigners in this world. I think about Jacob. Jacob needed a little discipline as well as some experience, training. And really, as it worked out, he had to go live as a foreigner back in the land of Haran. Live as a sojourner, as he himself would describe it, with his uncle Laban, and suffer the things that would happen to him there. It does seem interesting to me how many times that happened, that God, to prepare somebody for some task or for some role, would take them away from their home and let them learn what it was like to be an outsider in another land. And I suggest that all of that really, well, let me illustrate it one other way. There's for God's people, Old Testament or New Testament, whether we're talking about the children of Israel back there or whether we're talking about us now, when God blesses us, it is so easy for us to settle down and enjoy the blessings and get to looking at the world and the things of this world as our home and as our place of security. That was the temptation the children of Israel faced. They come into the land of promise. They have all these good things. God warned them. He says, now don't forget me. Don't start thinking that this is all by your strength of power. Don't forget me. There was even a law that God gave them that was designed to impress that fact on them. Look at the book of Leviticus, the 25th chapter. In Leviticus chapter 25, it's another one of these parts of the Bible, particularly one of these parts of the Old Testament that we don't stray into very often. But in Leviticus, the 25th chapter, the 23rd verse, God was giving instructions about the Sabbath, which included not only the Sabbath day once a week, but it also included the Sabbath year. And not only included the Sabbath year, but it included what they called the Jubilee, which was sort of the Sabbath of Sabbaths. And that was every 50th year. They'd go 7 times 7, 49 years, and then the 50th year, they would celebrate a Jubilee. And one of the things that was done in that year of Jubilee was any property that had been sold in the intervening 49 years went back to its original owner. Which really means like you couldn't really sell it. I mean, you could, in effect, you could sort of rent it out. You could sell it, but you only got to buy it for the whatever time remained of that particular Jubilee cycle. Now, why did he do that? Well, some people have suggested economic theory that it kept things kind of evenly distributed, and I'm sure it did that. But that's not the reason that really is given right here. Notice in Leviticus chapter 25 and verse 23, when God explains why he did that, He said, the land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. He says, you think you can sell this permanently, you'll start thinking this land really belongs to you, that this is really your home. He says, and it's not, and it doesn't belong to you. He says, you are but aliens and sojourners with me. He says, this is not really your home. I know this is the promised land and all of that, but this is not the real promised land. This is not really your home. It belongs to me. You're just sojourners here. You're just aliens in this world. Well, when we come to the New Testament, we find the same theme. We find the same emphasis. Remember what Jesus said when somebody wanted to follow him? Look over to the Gospel of Luke, the 9th chapter. In Luke chapter 9, down about verse 57, says, and as they were going along the road, someone said to him, I will follow you wherever you go. You remember Jesus' response in verse 58? Jesus said to him, the foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And I don't think Jesus was just saying, I'm poor and can't afford a house. I don't know exactly what the financial circumstances were. Jesus obviously was not a wealthy person by this world's standards. I don't know whether he really had anything that he really called his own other than the clothes on his back. I know that the apostles as a group had money. And Jesus with them, apparently that they supplied their needs out of that money bag of which Judas was the treasurer. Other than that, we really don't know much of anything about the financial circumstances, but Jesus apparently didn't even have a place as far as even this world was concerned that he called home. He says he didn't even have a place to lay his head. And I find that striking, but also it fits right in with exactly what Jesus had come to do. Back in the Gospel of John, the first chapter, John chapter 1, where we're told that in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. Then in verse 14, talking about Jesus coming to this earth, says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. Now, your Bible may or may not have a footnote there by the word dwelt. The word became flesh and dwelt among us. If it's got a little footnote right there, the footnote would probably indicate something like the word that's actually used right there is tabernacle. As a verb. Tabernacle is a tent, a temporary dwelling. That is, when Christ came, he didn't come to call this earth his home. He didn't come to set up permanent residence. He came here just as a... Now, we understand that with regard to Jesus, that he came here just temporarily. We say, oh, yeah, his home's in heaven. The whole point is that that's true of all of God's people, that their real home, their real citizenship is in heaven. And as far as our lives and the time that we are here on this earth, it is no more our permanent home than it was Jesus' permanent home. We are just tabernacling here. We are just dwelling in tents. The real promised land, as a number of our songs, including even one that we sang this morning, indicate, the real land of Canaan for God's people is not that piece of real estate over there between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. The real land of Canaan, the real promised land, the land that that really belongs to us, is heaven itself. And so, we are like Jesus, just tabernacling here, just dwelling here in tents. The Apostle Paul would say in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 that while we are at home on earth, we are absent from the Lord, and our desire is to be absent from earth and at home with the Lord. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 11, Paul talks about the fact that here on this earth we have no certain dwelling. Oh, we may buy us a house and we may have a mortgage that looks eternal. But we have no certain dwelling here on this earth. It can all be taken away at a moment's notice. Why? Because we say, yeah, I'm a citizen of the United States. I'm a resident of Hillsborough County. I've got all the documents to prove it. But all of that really is just ephemeral. It all can vanish at a moment. Our real citizenship is for us as Christians, for those of us who are in Christ, who had nowhere to lay his head, our real citizenship is in heaven. Paul, one of the passages that the more I think about it, the more I think I've learned from it over the years. In Philippians chapter 3, verse 20, he says, "For our citizenship is in heaven, from which we also eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ." He says, the city that we are residents in is the heavenly city, the heavenly Jerusalem. Not any earthly city, not Jerusalem on earth, not Rome on earth, not Tampa or Temple Terrace or Antioch or whatever town or village that we might claim. He says, our real citizenship is in heaven. And when we come to realize that, then it begins to make more sense. What does it mean to say that we are just pilgrims here? We're out of place. And it's nice. You know how much of our lives we spend trying to fit in, trying to feel like we belong, trying to feel like we're comfortable here, and we just kind of merge right into the landscape of everybody else. That's really not what we're supposed to be doing. What does it really mean? Let me suggest very quickly some things it ought to mean to us to say that we are just strangers and pilgrims. First of all, with regard to our very body. So many times in the Bible, our bodies are described as a tent. Sometimes as a house, but usually as a tent. Why a tent? Because a tent, you just pull up one little cord and it all collapses. Tents are made to be portable, to move from one place to another. You put up a tent where you're planning on moving on shortly. And you're aware of how fragile it is and how easily it can be knocked down. And so, in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1, Paul describes our bodies, the tent that we have from the Lord. The Lord gave us a tent to camp out for a little while here. But our real bodies, you might say, are those that we'll receive for dwelling in heaven, our real home. When we say that we're pilgrims here, something else it means, some people spend all their lives looking for what it is here on earth that they feel they've got coming to them, what it is that's going to make them happy. But if we really understand that we are just pilgrims here, whatever it is we're really looking for, we're not going to find it here. And if we consume our whole life trying to find what's going to make us happy, trying to find what's going to give us fulfillment, it's going to be a wasted life. Because if our citizenship really is in heaven, we're not going to find it here. We're going to find it in heaven. It also means, people that are foreigners always do things that the people around them, it doesn't seem to make any sense. Somebody comes over here from another country and they'll engage in some little action or ritual or maybe some expression they'll use. We say, that's silly. It doesn't make sense. And if you go live in some foreign country, you'll pretty soon find that some of the things that you do look pretty silly to the folks there too. And that's going to be true of us here as God's people. We're going to do things that, as far as this world's concerned, it just doesn't make sense. In 1 Peter chapter 4, remember that's the letter that even is addressed to Christians as strangers and pilgrims. And we read from it, start with, over in chapter 4. He says, starting in verse 1, "Therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same purpose, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. So as to live the rest of the time, the rest of the time that you're doing here on earth, in the flesh, no longer for the lust of men, but for the will of God. For the time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desires of the Gentiles." You've already devoted yourself to life, seeking things of this world long enough. Now you've got something else to do. Now, it says, having pursued a course of sensuality, of lust, of drunkenness, carousals, drinking parties, abominable idolatries. And in all this, now he says, they are surprised that you do not run with them to the same excess of dissipation. And they malign. His people in the world are going to make fun of you when you live in a way that just doesn't seem to make that. Why don't you just do what feels good now? I can't understand that. And they'll mock. You may suffer more than mockery. Another thing that we have to prepare for is that people who are conscious of the fact that they're foreigners and are willing to remain, they're never really accepted by the people around them. Well, some people make every effort to fit in and eventually do. But we're not called upon to fit in with this world. In fact, we are warned that we're not going to fit in, that the world is not going to accept us. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 15, passage we've already read from in part, but in Hebrews chapter 11, and down verse 35 and so, Hebrews chapter 11, starting in verse 35, listing all of the things that had happened to pilgrims here in this world. Says women received back their dead by resurrection. Others were tortured, not accepting their release in order that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others experienced mocking and scourging, yes, and also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn asunder. They were tempted. They were put to death with a sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated. And then notice the parenthetical expression, men of whom the world was not worthy. They didn't fit in. They were never accepted. They were eventually driven from this world, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. People who were pilgrims, who never really quite fit in. I think it is very instructive for us to look at our own lives and realize how much we work, how much effort we expend, how hard we work just trying to fit in with the people around us. I realize there's a sense in which that's appropriate. I certainly am not trying to counsel that we as Christians ought to try and become oddballs and obnoxious cranks in the neighborhood. But I am saying that if we live godly lives, we are inevitably going to be perceived that way. And if we make trying to fit in, trying to not rock the boat, trying to be comfortable, that's sort of one of the great values of our society today. You don't want to do or say anything that's going to make anybody uncomfortable. And if that becomes the standard by which we measure everything, we will fit in. And once we fit in at that level, this world really has become our home. If we're going to say that we are really pilgrims, that means we're going to have to walk by faith and not by sight. It means we're going to have to turn down some opportunities to settle down. The passage we read from Hebrews emphasized that Abraham could have returned. He had lots of opportunities. We're going to have lots of opportunities to settle down and make this world our home. We'll have face a lot of temptation to live according to the standard of the people around us. You know, when in Rome, do as the Romans. That can become a great excuse for compromising everything that we believe in and stand for. But what God calls upon us to do is, when on earth, live as if we were in heaven. Live according to the standards of our real country. No. If you really believe in the values of your home country and you go visit another, you don't, when in Rome, do as the Romans. You stick up for what you believe in. And if we really are committed to the principles of heaven, if we are really committed to godly standards, then we'll live according to that even when we live in an ungodly world and when a completely different way of living would be accepted. And we also won't let ourselves get too tied to this world. We won't, you remember all the patriarchs, they wanted their children not to take a wife from the people around them, but go back to their homeland. Don't get too tied to this world. And we won't invest here either. Jesus says, lay not up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust corrupt, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. You think about all of that. I have to confess that it's embarrassing how much of my time I spend trying to make a home here on this earth. Spent all yesterday trying to get the garage straightened out, you know. Thinking about how wonderful it would be to be able to pull my cars, both cars, in there and park. And sit back out on the back porch and look out and say, this is my home. It is so tempting to make that the primary focus of our lives. And look at it and say, see how God has blessed me that I have always this wonderful home. Well, on the one hand, I do want to be appreciative of the blessings that God has given me. But on the other hand, it can be so seductive, so easy to say, that's the home God's prepared for me. Abraham knew better. David knew better. That even in the promised land on this earth, they were still looking for the city which had foundations, whose builder and maker was God. They still knew that none of it really belongs to us. And that all of it would pass. By way of invitation this morning, I want to suggest that there was one brief moment in the history of man in which he was not a pilgrim on this earth. The Garden of Eden was man's true home. We're never told that Adam was just a sojourner or an alien in the Garden of Eden. But it was sin that caused man to be driven from that home that God had prepared for him. That sin resulted even in a curse upon the ground that it should bring forth thorns and thistles. And now this whole world is destined for destruction. 2 Peter chapter 3 talks about all these things being consumed and destroyed. But of course, as long as we're sinners, we feel at home in this sin-cursed world. We fit in. But godly men, people who live holy lives, ultimately can never feel really at home. So the invitation this morning is for you to place your citizenship in heaven. For you to declare that this world is not your home. We've had ample time to live according to the lust of this world, says Peter in 1 Peter chapter 4. Can't we devote the rest of our lives to the real home that God has prepared for us, for those who've been cleansed of their sins by the blood of Christ? If there's somebody that needs to obey the gospel, to declare that this world is not his home, to set his heart towards the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God, who needs to obey the gospel, the invitation is extended for you to make your desire to do that known while we stand and sing the song that's been selected.